From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. T.J. Stiles is my guest this week. His latest book is the monumental The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, a biography as well as a sweeping history of the times in which Vanderbilt lived. This book has wars, Supreme Court decisions, the origin of the stock market, presidential politics, and that's all in the first 50 pages. T.J. Stiles, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much.
What I want to know, what's been concerning me through the whole reading of this gigantic book, before we talk about Vanderbilt, is how you go about organizing and putting together a book like this. I mean, can you take us through sort of the stages, the first stages of creation? You decide to write a book about Vanderbilt, I suppose, because he's fascinating to you and because you have things you want to comment about. But what happens then?
Well, in Vanderbilt's case, his life was, you know, the sort of bare skeleton of his story is pretty clear. It's his business career. And his business career fell into three distinct parts. His early decades as a steamboat entrepreneur, when steamboats were a new technology, his move into ocean-going steamships, and with that his role in the California Gold Rush and America's relationship to Europe, and then with the Civil War, his transformation into the great railroad king of 19th century America. So those are three very distinct segments, and so the book's organized in three parts. And then, because his life was very much shaped by battles, by business battles, he was an intensely competitive man in a very competitive era, a no-holds-barred era of American capitalism. And so his business career is really shaped by these conflicts with successive opponents on a larger and larger and larger scale. So the chapters tend to be organized around, it was pretty easy to organize the chapters around, you know, each of these battles within those three parts. But the hard part came with what else is necessary. You know, what else do we need to know to understand Vanderbilt's life and also to, you know, get the most out of the story? And I'd had to do a lot of rewriting. Some of my early chapters, I submitted an initial draft and my editor said, you know, there's something missing. And, you know, that was a process of digesting questions about American history and looking at his life and really trying to think fresh about what things meant. So I tried to tell a really big story as well as an intimate story.
And that's the amazing thing about it, is that you definitely accomplished that. And you keep it from being dry. I mean, it feels very much like an adventure story.
Well, thanks. I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, you know, there's parts where I have to explain, you know, paper money or people's ideas about what the value of a share of stock should be. And, you know, the question as a writer is, you know, what does the reader need to know to go on to the next part? And how do I present this information so the reader wants to turn the page? And if I find that I'm just explaining things because I know it, you know, I found out about it, and there's no real purpose, then it doesn't belong on the page. If it's not driving the story ahead, then the information shouldn't be in there. So, so that's kind of the editing process, the weaning process. You know, you always throw in too much, and some of it has to come out. And trying to make that information, only the information that I think really drives things ahead.
Well, how much of it did you already know?
Well, let's put it this way. When I got very interested in Vanderbilt when I was working on my previous book about Jesse James, because in the whole asking the whole question of whether Jesse James really was an anti-railroad Robin Hood, I did a big investigation of the financial system and the railroad system, and, you know, it was a really fascinating story, the rise of the corporate economy. And so Vanderbilt was a very colorful, dramatic guy. You know, he wasn't a dry bookkeeper type. So I thought, this is an interesting character, and he was a very important businessman, and he hasn't had a real comprehensive biography before. Okay, so I was fortunate enough to get a contract with Knopf, and, you know, we decided it would be 2 years and I would deliver the manuscript. Well, that was 7 years ago. and you know, part of the reason is luck. Part of it is just, you know, like I said, having to go back and really understand what was happening in American history. There are all these huge transformations and struggles that Vanderbilt was very much a part of. You know, we don't think of a businessman as being involved in some of the things you mentioned, you know, presidential politics and cultural changes and political changes. And, you know, Vanderbilt's story is woven right through, you know, the making of modern America. So, you know, the big questions, you know, I didn't realize I'd be tackling a lot of them at the outset. And then the information about him, you know, I just kept finding things and kept finding things until it got to the point where I was finishing up my final draft of the book and I was terrified that I'd find something else and have to add another year onto the process. I really didn't want to have to do that. So, I was lucky that I found as much as I did.
What was the, you say you got a contract before you actually launched into the writing. So how did you pitch this thing? I'm going to write an 800-page book. It's all set in the 19th century. It's all about money. I mean,
yeah, it's, you know, and that's the thing is that, you know, I try to write books that that bridge, you know, that combine kind of scholarly qualities and literary qualities. You know, I want a professional historian to pick up this book and learn something from it and to feel like, yeah, this guy really did his homework and he did things right. And I want a general reader who's kind of interested in the past and about how the modern world came to be and wants a good story to pick up the book and enjoy it and feel like they learned something but they had a good time reading it. And so, when I come up with an idea for a book and I approach a publisher, it's that combination of, you know, informing and entertaining. You know, this is a way of talking about important subjects and at the same time of telling a good story. And that's the kind of book that, you know, gets attention from reviewers and that people will tell their friends that they should go out and buy at the same time. And so, you know, that's the line that I try to draw. You know, I got a graduate education in history at Columbia University, and I just couldn't see myself going down the academic track. You know, you have to spend years and years becoming an expert in some narrow little subject mm-hmm. when, you know, I was interested in good stories and big questions. And, you know, after you've got tenure, when you've been a historian about 20 years, they let you write that kind of book. And so it took me a while. You know, I worked in publishing and did little projects on the side, and finally I was able to start my career as a biographer, but you know that's the approach. When I go to a publisher, it's really trying to say, you know, this is an interesting guy and he's got a big story too.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with T.J. Stiles, and his new book is called The First Tycoon: The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. And he also wrote Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War. I was wondering if Jesse James was going to make a cameo in this book, but I guess he doesn't appear unless I missed it. I don't think he's in here.
No, that was another surprise, is that a lot of historians have thought that Vanderbilt was involved in Western railroads. And what I found is that his interest in railroads didn't go any farther west than Chicago. Some of the confusion stems from one of the best stories in the book, as far as I'm concerned. His son-in-law, Horace F. Clark, was his right-hand man for many years. And when Vanderbilt acquired a railroad that connected New York State to Chicago, he put the son-in-law, Clark, in charge. But Clark, by that stage in his life, really wanted to establish himself on his own. And, you know, his eyes got a little too big, and he started to go off into a whole bunch of side enterprises of his own, including becoming president of the Union Pacific Railroad. And what I found is that instead of that being a sign that, oh, Vanderbilt, you know, bought the Union Pacific and put Clark in charge, it was actually the story of how his son-in-law was kind of betraying him and undermining this empire that he was building. And it's one of the stories that runs through the last part of the book, is how this dynasty is sort of, there are these dynastic struggles within the Vanderbilt house, so to speak.
And that battle really heats up after Vanderbilt's death, I guess.
Yeah, what happened is Vanderbilt brought in, through the course of his career, he brought in sons-in-law especially. He had three sons, and he had a number of daughters. One of his sons, he actually had one son who died in infancy, another daughter who was an invalid. She seems to have had, you know, some kind of defect or disability. And he was very disappointed in his sons. His younger son, George Washington Vanderbilt, went to West Point. He was athletic. He seems to have been Vanderbilt's favorite. But he contracted a disease in the Civil War, never even saw combat, and died in 1864. His middle son is sort of the anti-hero of my book. Vanderbilt named him after himself, Cornelius Jeremiah Vanderbilt. And he's exact opposite of his father. He was, Vanderbilt was very close-mouthed, very sort of dignified guy who really polished his reputation as a man of his word. And a very tough businessman, but always honest and true to his word. His son was a gambling addict, something that I think actually started when he came to California during the gold rush. He was a gambling addict. He was epileptic, so he was kind of weak and sickly, whereas Cornelius Vanderbilt, the Commodore, his father, was an athlete. He was a liar. He managed to win the friendship of famous men, including Horace Greeley, and borrowed money from them, and he gambled it away. And just this amazing kind of counterpoint to Vanderbilt's career is the story of his son. And their relationship really unlocks the emotional complexities of Commodore Vanderbilt, who, you know, is seen as this kind of flat, two-dimensional figure. He's such a giant. And his son kind of brought out all of his emotional complexities. And then there's that oldest son, William Henry Vanderbilt, who started off, he had a nervous breakdown early in life, and Vanderbilt thought he was good for nothing and sent him to a farm. And he built that farm up into a very successful operation, became a good businessman. And Vanderbilt brought him in when he got into railroads as his operational manager. He was very good at it. So what Vanderbilt did is he deliberately wanted to found a dynasty. So he gave 95% of his estate, which was estimated at $100 million when he died, he gave 95% of it to that one son. And then his other nine surviving children, he left them, you know, what were large amounts at the time, but were a tiny percentage of the total estate. So there was a massive trial over the will, and it was the trial of the century. All of the salacious details, some of them true, many of them false, came out about the Commodore, and it was on the front pages of newspapers for 2 years. And finally, William won, and then he turned around to mend fences. He doubled everybody else's stake, but he kept control of the empire. And all the Vanderbilts that we've heard of since, down to Gloria Vanderbilt, are descendants from that one son of the 13 children who survived into adulthood, or whom he had, 13 children. And so it's a really interesting story, and I bookend the book with that will trial because, you know, it's kind of ironic that he wanted to found a dynasty, but that very attempt split his children against each other.
Well, how much would $100 million be now?
You know, I don't give modern-day equivalent amounts.
Yeah.
I think the 19th century economy is just too different, and there's a lot of reasons for it. But what I do is look at the count of how much money was circulating in the economy then and now. And so if you use, you know, the Fed's M2 figure, which includes a lot of things like cash and demand deposits and a lot of other stuff, you take Bill Gates. If he was able, right before the crash last year, to sell his whole estate at market value to American buyers only, he would have taken one out of every, I think it's $138 out of the economy. Now, represents a huge chunk of the nation's wealth. That's not a percentage of the total economy. You know, that's the money supply, but that tells you how rich he is. If Vanderbilt could have done the same thing at the moment of his death, sold his whole estate, if you use the Treasury's figure for cash and bank deposits, he would have taken one out of $20. So you have Bill Gates, you know, whose estate would sell for one out of every $138. Vanderbilt's one out of 20. And if you look at cash only, it's one out of every $9. So this guy was so vastly richer than not only anyone in his own time, but than anyone could be in today's time. I mean, in our larger and more complex economy, it's not even possible for someone to be that rich. So it kind of boggles the mind when you think about how much power as well as wealth he had.
It's astounding. You mentioned the name Commodore, which mm-hmm. he's known. How did he acquire this name? Because he never was in the military, right?
That's right. Commodore, I've read various conflicting accounts, but I think I nailed it down in my book. Some people have said that it was a mockery when he was a young man before he became successful, you know, when he had a small sailboat. In fact, Commodore, which was the highest rank in the U.S. Navy until the Civil War, was a nickname that the press gave to successful steamboat entrepreneurs. There were actually a few men who were known as Commodore. But so Vanderbilt was one of them. They called him Commodore Vanderbilt. But as he became far more successful than anyone else, the nickname Commodore, you know, like if he'd been started 20 years later, they might have called him Admiral. But Commodore was the highest rank in the Navy, and it stuck to him because he was just eventually became so much more successful than anyone else. And it's weird because it's a title that he accepted, that even his family used. His second wife called him in her diary and letters, she referred to him as Com. And, you know, so, you know, he accepted it. And, you know, if you refer to the Commodore, everybody in America knew who you were talking about.
He was the Commodore.
He was the Commodore, exactly.
Yeah, wow. We're talking with T.J. Stiles, and his book is called The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. You talk about his dynasty that he was hoping for, but you argue in the book that the dynasty that he created really wasn't a family dynasty, but rather a dynasty of tycoons.
It's interesting. You know, his family remained wealthy for, you know, a few more generations, and many of them who remained the wealthiest married into other wealthy families. But they, you know, they got their wealth from America's first big industry, and it was also the first industry to mature and you know, kind of run into trouble, and eventually it was taken over by the government, of course, the railroads.
And that was the end of the railroads also, right?
I'm sorry?
That was the end of the railroads also.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, now we have some private companies again that are operating, and actually some of them are doing pretty well as fuel prices become an issue. But, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, you know, railroads are taken over, you know, by state and federal governments. So, you know, the source of the family's wealth crumbled. But what happened is that I argue Vanderbilt actually built some really important infrastructure. You know, his statue is out in front of Grand Central Terminal in Manhattan today, and there's a good reason for it. He built the original Grand Central. He built the tunnel, originally an open tunnel, but now it's covered over, the tunnel that runs down Park Avenue that allowed a kind of grimy street to become the luxurious Park Avenue. He built a lot of infrastructure that helped keep New York City the major American city even after shipping started to fade. But his real legacy is not in his family or in his specific industry. It's really the way that he modernized American finance and the way he pioneered the giant corporation. You know, when he started out, corporations were considered to be sort of like a special little thing that the government did to convince private investors to undertake a public project. And by the end of his life, it was simply a rational way of organizing a business. And he took these small little corporations and these small little railroads, and he merged them together into a giant, one of the first giant corporations, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad. And it not only made the economy much more efficient in terms of the moving of goods, he created vast wealth. He pioneered the polarization of wealth because his personal estate was so much larger than even the next richest person in America's. That kind of the era of great fortunes and all the troubling social questions that come with it, he pioneered. And then he also transformed things like politics. You know, the radicals in early America had thought that the government should stay out of the economy. But with the rise of big business, which Vanderbilt led, you know, it caused them to say, you know, we need the government to counterbalance the power of big corporations. And you see them in his lifetime arguing about this stuff in terms of him. He represented this new power in society. So, you know, his story is this amazing rags-to-riches story, unparalleled in American history. And yet, at the same time, it also touches on all these larger questions. And so, you know, Wall Street today, the giant corporation today, the way that we, you know, store our value in shares of stock and trade on Wall Street, that's all part of Vanderbilt's legacy.
His life also bridged the eras of, you know, an agrarian colonial society to an industrial one.
That's right. And one of the ways in which his life is interesting in that sense is that, you know, one of his reasons why he was successful is that he had a real sense for where the main artery of American commerce was. So, you know, New York was always the most important city from the time he entered business after the War of 1812, actually during the War of 1812, until, you know, today. New York was always kind of the premier business center. And so he, first with steamboat and later with railroad lines, he would shift his interests from one route to the next depending on where the main artery of trade was. So his story kind of tells his personal life tells the story of the rise of the American economy and even American geography. So, you know, when Philadelphia was the big city financial center other than New York, he was in the New York to Philadelphia route. When the Erie Canal opened up trade to the west, he moved into New York to Albany with his steamboats. Then when industrialization started in New England with the first textile mills, he got into the routes between New York and Boston. California Gold Rush, he switched to these steamship routes that ran to San Francisco, connecting by way of Central America. And then with the rise of the Midwest, you know, after the Civil War, New York to Chicago was where his railroad lines ran. So, you know, it does, his life does trace this, not only, you know, directly was he involved with the rise of the American economy, but, you know, you follow basically, you know, where the active center of things were just by looking at what he was doing.
He was also interested in things like, well, like seances, you mentioned.
Yes, and this is something that is both really interesting and also shouldn't be overblown. He was someone who was not at all pious. As a matter of fact, he was kind of notably, in a country that was pretty religious and very Christian, he was notably unreligious. And but he was kind of superstitious. And starting in the Civil War, about the time that his son died, he showed a real interest in seances, contacting the dead. You know, he would speak to relatives, old friends, to old dead business colleagues. And I think this is interesting because, you know, he was a man who was used to controlling everything. And so I think there's something about the idea that he could even tame death itself was probably appealing to him. And he also lived much longer than most people in his era did. So by the time he was in his 70s, you know, almost everybody he'd ever known was dead. But again, it shouldn't be overblown because this is the great era of spiritualism in American life. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Americans went to seances. It was an era when, you know, it hadn't been debunked. A lot of very serious intellectual people believed that it was either true or might be possible to contact the dead. And so Vanderbilt was not that unusual. And so, you know, it's kind of weird, but at the same time, it doesn't make him out to be some kind of wacko.
Well, I guess in an era when we're suddenly discovering things like the wireless and so forth, it makes...
Yeah, the wireless came a little later, but, you know, you think about the telegraph. You know, that this is a guy who was, when he was born, you know, there was no mechanical power, there were no steam engines, there were no telegraph, there were certainly no telephone. The telephone was invented during his lifetime. You know, all of these technologies...
Photography also?
Yeah, photography, exactly. There was no photography. It's a good point. And so all of these technologies came about during his lifetime. You're right. I mean, you know, the idea that you could find a way to contact the dead, you know, kind of made sense.
Seems only natural.
It seems only natural. It would be the next step.
Yeah.
It also shouldn't be overblown because, you know, Vanderbilt always kept his own counsel. And so people have suggested that, you know, he contacted the dead for business tips. And I found one example, a witness described a seance where he contacted the ghost of Jim Fisk, who was an old rival who was shot by a rival for a mistress. So he calls up the ghost of Jim Fisk, the medium does, and so Vanderbilt asked him some questions, and of course about stock on Wall Street. And of course the answers made no sense at all because, you know, they're coming from the medium.
Right.
And so Vanderbilt, instead of, you know, taking it seriously, he says, "What are you talking about?" And he gets into an argument with the ghost of Jim Fisk. And so it's a funny scene, but I think it shows why he was so successful, even though he was contacting the dead. You know, he might talk about business with a ghost, but I think he followed his own advice.
Well, you mentioned that Vanderbilt lived into his 80s, but, you know, he almost died a few times before that. But if he had died before he was, say, 50, you would never have written this book.
That's right. And what's interesting is he still would have been important, but he would have been this footnote figure in terms of, you know, modern history. I mean, historians would know about him. And, you know, I can think of, you know, in the course of this book, I came across the lives of dozens of businessmen who are enormously important in the 19th century, and yet, you know, we don't know about now. And, you know, men like William Aspinwall, a guy who really helped forge the steamship traffic to San Francisco during the Gold Rush, absolutely critical in the birth of California, and yet nobody knows who he is today. Vanderbilt, you know, his longevity really speaks to why he's important. You know, he's able to build on his previous success and yet also completely transform himself when he saw an opportunity. And, you know, he started off sailing a sailboat between Manhattan and Staten Island. And he ended, you know, as master of this huge railroad empire. That longevity really, really does, is one of the reasons why he's, you know, why we remember him today.
Well, it's an amazing book, and I want everybody to know that it's called The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, and it's nothing short of an epic accomplishment from our guest, T.J. Stiles. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll be back again with another show next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.